Hi guys, and welcome back to the PE podcast. Today we're going to film our first ever double guest episode. We're going to be talking to Paul and Caroline Robinson. You may know Paul from playing for football teams such as Watford, West Bromwich Albion and Birmingham City. And we're going to meet the man behind the leader. What skills does he need to motivate individuals and motivate teams around him? What has he learned from having such a long and successful career in professional sport in terms of what is success to a football club? What makes a good coach, a good manager, a good physio, a good nutritionist and so on? We're also going to talk to his wife and learn about the leader behind the captain. What skills did she need to help Paul in his career? And also going to talk about her experiences with anxiety and panic attacks and her successful Instagram TV series called Let's Talk Mental Health, where people come on and share their experiences with mental health, help others understand the feelings they may be going through, and offer some reassurance and advice about how they can overcome their own challenges. So sit back, relax, and enjoy today's episode. Right then, Paul, could you give me a bit of an insight into your playing career before we get started in terms of clubs you've played for, any achievements and those sorts of things? Then we'll go on to Caroline in just a moment.
Yep, so Paul Robinson, come through the Watford Academy from the age of 9, made my first team debut at the age of 17, left there in 2003, went on to West Bromwich Albion where I spent 7 years there as well, then moved on to Bolton, so I had 3 years at Bolton. Towards the end of that contract, I had 10 games at Leeds United, so went on loan to Leeds, then didn't have a club for 3 months, and then signed month-to-month contracts with Birmingham City Football Club in 2012, it was, and then retired at the age of 39. So yeah, I had a long, long career.
And yourself, Caroline, what? Tell us something about yourself.
So I was really lucky. Paul and I met when I was 20, and I was really lucky that I had a really strong upbringing, and at the time I was working, I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Met Paul, and then I was, as I say, really lucky to be able to have 4 children and be a mum, which I feel very, very lucky to be a full-time mum. And then throughout having those children, I feel like I obviously had my struggles, which we'll talk about later on, and because of those struggles I went on to try and find alternative support to help myself and to also help my children and also to help Paul. And then after having severe panic attacks, I found acupuncture, and that was really like a defining moment, and that was what drove me really to do a degree equivalent with 4 children and a busy husband, but yeah, to be an acupuncturist. So that's what I do now.
Incredible. So obviously we're talking here then to two very successful people, driven, determined. So let's go to your playing career then, Paul. So it'll be easy for people to find all the positives and the successes of your careers, but could you just give us a bit of an insight into how you deal with setbacks or challenges? I think you got relegated with Watford. And how did you deal with that? How do you overcome that? What attributes do you have in terms of that, those mental skills to overcome those setbacks?
Well, when I was young, I had really good mentors around me. So I had people like Graham Taylor, Kenny Jackett, Luther Blissett, Tom Whalley. So I had people that were there that would always give me a lift and always keep me believing that there was always great opportunities to look forward to again. Yes, you're going to suffer disappointments throughout your career. It's part and parcel of football. It's part and parcel of life. We're going to go through these periods where we have these ups and downs. So for me, it was learning. It was a great learning curve that to suffer relegation was a disappointment. And to feel the way that you did, obviously you then wanted to come back in a positive frame of mind, and you wanted to strive to make the most of the enjoyments, which was promotion again and winning games. I always looked at the negatives and tried to turn them into positives. And that was to continuously believe in myself and my ability as a player.
It's quite interesting you say that. I've recently spoke to Darren Carter, and he had a very similar sort of outlook, in terms of don't get too high with the highs, but also don't get too low with the lows. So, you know, accept what's happened, look forward to the future, try and move on, look what's coming up, and don't let that previous sort of challenge hold you back. My experience as a Birmingham City fan, I always saw you on the pitch as a leader, somebody who was able to lead people around them. But I want to sort of come on to you now, Caroline, in terms of were you a leader in terms of, were you the sort of captain at home with Paul and your children in terms of keeping him on the right track and not letting him maybe sort of wallow in a little bit of anger or disappointment. How did you do that? How did you sort of help guide him back on track and keep him going?
Well, we have a bit of a joke with two mugs in our house for the coffee. And one is Gaffer and one is Gaffer's Gaffer. And I just let you like guess which one, you know, I have usually. No, with all joking aside. I think it's really important. We're very lucky that we met really young and we got on really well and we had fun together and we really respect each other. And I think that's something that's really important. And I think that obviously with being in a high profile job, it is a lot of pressure for the partner to manage the ups and the downs, because with, for example, my dad, you know, his job would have been very much like it's monotonous, or he loved his job, but it was very much like this. There wasn't any ups and downs. Whereas Paul's job, it was either up or down. There was never any kind of calmness. It was like we're either we've won or we've lost, and that's just horrendous. So my job was about bringing a little bit of stability to him, and also to show him the other sides of life and the children. And so there was a lot of pressure at times to be that person. But I think that because we do have that strength together, it was a team effort. And that sounds really cliche, but I felt like in the good times, we really appreciated those. But in the down times, we really dug in and we really supported each other.
I like that. I like the Gaffer's Gaffer thing. That's brilliant. How did you deal with it as well then, Paul? How did you deal with setbacks in terms of when you come home? How do you switch off? Because I think some of our students come home from school, and I know it's a very different environment, but they come home from school, especially at the moment, year 10s and 11s, they've got GCSEs coming up, and they almost take it home with them. They finish their day at school, but that's not really the end, because they know there's something coming up. Is that sort of weighing on their shoulders? There's an exam coming up, or they've got coursework to submit. How do you switch off from that? Because I think our students, potentially some of them don't put the effort in, but then some of them put too much effort in, which is a negative as well. And they take it not too seriously, but it becomes detrimental to their revision or the work that they're producing. How do you switch off after a day at work?
Yeah, I mean, I struggled at first. I struggled to switch off because I'm quite emotional. I'm quite passionate about my job and what I love doing. At first I really struggled. I sort of brought a lot of stuff home with me, which was no good. It was no good for the family. It was no good for me, my headspace, because I wasn't then with my family at times when I should have been. I found it really difficult to just switch off from it all. So I would definitely recommend that if you get that 10, 15 minutes to yourself, either listen to music, visualize, think of positive stuff before you come home to your family, or say if you're going to see some friends, then just find that time to spend it by yourself, just to switch off and try and think of something that's going to get you in a positive frame of mind, where you're then in a better space, you're around the people that you want to be around, and you're happy and you're involved in conversations. You're not in another space where someone's talking to you and they can see that you're not there. So it's trying to find that balance. We do say balance sometimes, but it's just trying to find that switch off point where you know that you can't bring everything home and you have to find a way of trying to see something different, that it's always going to be a positive no matter what. So you've just got to find that. Yeah.
I love that. We try and do it in school at the moment in terms of that 10 to 15 minutes to switch off and cut out any of the negatives and try and focus on something that keeps you happy. And it's something we've spoken about at Alderbrook in our department in terms of in PE lessons, trying to do maybe a 4 or 5 week block in terms of putting together something for mindfulness and how to achieve that. And we speak in PE that there's obviously the physical goals, but PE or health is physical, social and mental. And we thought about doing a yoga lesson, a Pilates lesson, a mindfulness lesson, a breathing lesson, just to relax, going for a walk around the playing field for one of the groups or something like that, to teach some of our students that, you know, these aren't just, I know, sorry, to go off topic about ever so slightly, I used to look at things like these breathing techniques and I used to think, that won't work. It's just words. Somebody's just saying it because they think it works or that sort of thing. And I used to think it wasn't very effective, but the more you hear about people's experiences in terms of having those 15 minutes to listen, 15 minutes to breathe, 15 minutes to relax, it is really beneficial and really positive. And hopefully some of our students or other students listening to this can apply it to their own lives. I did an assembly probably about a year ago, and I showed a video of Carlos Puyol. And I think he'd been slapped by an opponent. I can't remember if it was from Real Madrid or if it was from Valencia or somebody in a white shirt. And his teammates rushed straight over to him, as you expect every good friend to stand up for your friend if they've been hit or whatever. But then he sort of put himself between his teammates and the opponent and guided them in the right direction. So as easy as it would have been for Carlos to let his teammates start pushing and shoving, he knew that although he respected maybe the idea of them protecting him, the best thing for him as a captain, as a leader, was to block them and keep them away from potentially damaging their own hopes or their own success or their own team, the outcome at the end. Is that something that, when you said the gaffer's gaffer, that's what made me think of your thing, Caroline, in terms of Paul being very emotional and passionate, you being there just to sort of block it off and prevent it from going any further. And I think some of our students, especially the boys, and I know it's stereotypical, but they're almost like sheep. They follow one. If one goes, they all follow, and they all drag each other down. As a captain then, Paul, in terms of your footballing career, how do you lead? How do you become a good leader? And I think some of our students see football captains, and we might be in P and say, oh, you're the captain, and you're the captain of one team, or in one drill, you're the leader. And it's all motivation. They're shouting at their teammates and their friends, and they think it's all vocal. But we spoke before this about the term sort of role model, leading by example and listening. What is a good captain to you? How did you apply that into your own career? How were you such a successful captain?
I think a good captain is someone who's whole. He's the whole person. He's not just the captain of the football club. He's off the field. He's making sure the family, that a new player's come in, making sure the family's settled, the player themselves settled into the football club. So it's communication, making sure that they're safe, they're okay if they found the right houses. So it's always checking in to make sure that they're all right. Again, it's behind the scenes, getting to know everybody, not just the footballing staff or the management team. It's the groundsman, the people that work at the ground, the tickets, the commercial. It's understanding everybody. It's understanding the club that you work for and bringing it all together and connecting. I think that's the most important thing in any sport or any job, is that you're all on the same page. It's the cohesion. You all have different jobs, but you're all giving each other the right guidance to do those jobs to the best of your abilities. So for me, when I was leader of the club, it was important that everyone else was okay. I didn't need to worry about myself. I just needed to make sure that everyone else was all right, but I needed to make sure that they was all right for the right reasons. And they wasn't, like you said there, they wasn't the sheep, and they wasn't leading people down the wrong road. They wasn't guiding the senior pros, guiding the younger pros into things that they shouldn't have been doing. It's finding that right balance and giving them the right words of wisdom that they understand and how they can have great careers and do the right things. Yes, we're always going to make mistakes. It's life. We're going to make mistakes. But how quickly do you learn from their mistakes? That's the important thing, is that you learn from that mistake and you move on.
I think that's really, that's quite topical at the moment, or over the last sort of 5 or 6 years, in terms of having those right people around and guiding people in the right direction. There's been athletes, and obviously I'm never going to mention or tarnish anyone's name, but there's athletes from sort of Solihull area, Birmingham area, who are potentially didn't have the right friendship group around them, didn't have the right friends, and they guided them on the wrong path, and they potentially guided them for their own benefit, really. And they did things they wanted to do without thinking about the career of their friend or potential friend, or maybe somebody who's just paying for them to do this, that, or the other. And we have that in school. We have, you know, boys, again, it's stereotypical. It always seems to be boys that have this issue, in terms of there's a bit of a falling out, and there's one friend who will, you know, say something just to wind them up because they think it's funny and they think it's amusing. And then all of a sudden that gets out of hand and it becomes a fight, and they're sort of egging their friend on to have that fight. And at the end of the day, a fight isn't the end of the world, and it's not going to ruin anyone's school career, but it's not helpful. It's not helpful for that student. It's not helpful for that friendship group, really, because I think as they get older, they begin to realise who's really a friend and who's just an acquaintance who they see in school. And I think it potentially the same in professional football environment, who's a friend and who's somebody who's just a teammate. Moving on from that then, you've taken roles since leaving professional football. You've been commentating and punditry on Watford and have you done Blues TV?
No.
Not done Blues TV. So on Watford, is it Watford TV, is it?
Just the Watford TV.
Just yeah. Watford. But you've also had roles, professional roles at Birmingham City as well in terms of under 18 and lead professional development coach. What do you think that's like in Caradon? Have you seen a different side of Paul since his left football and retired from playing and gone into the other side of the game? Have you seen a difference in what he's like when he returns from work, or is he still just as passionate and as emotional about his position?
Do you know what? There's one thing I've got to say about Paul is that I've never met anyone who loves what they do like so wholeheartedly for the right reasons. And I know that footballers potentially, you know, they get a bad rap. But for as many that get a bad rap, there's so many amazing people that I've met within football. And so because he loves it so much, like he touched on earlier, he does find it hard to switch off. And so throughout his career, he would always analyse his games. Like he would always ask for his matches to be sent to him so he can see where he can develop and do better, even at the age of like 32, 33, 34, 35. And he was, when he was out of a club, he was still running on his own to just keep fit, to push himself through the snow. Like it was literally mind-blowing to see, even at that age, he had such a determination to keep going and to prove people wrong. So for Paul, it has been challenging to kind of keep him kind of more balanced into dad, husband life, because he is so passionate and he does spend a lot of time analysing. When he retired, I think the massive bonus for Paul is that he retired on his own terms. Like he knew when the time, he was very fortunate to have the career and he kind of had that time to get used to it in his head before it came to an end in a way. And I'm not saying it's been easy at all. It's still challenging, but because he went and he knew what he wanted to do, he wanted to go into coaching, he wanted to pass on his experience. The passion is still there, but it's more of a guidance. It's more of it comes from a slightly different place because the pressures are not there to perform and to be on it all the time. It's more of an objective. It comes from a slightly different place. And I think seeing him evolve has been really quite amazing. And I think through lockdown, it's given us the space, the family, to actually have Paul around because, you know, he wasn't hardly around very much. And I know people think that footballers, they have early days and stuff, but actually that analysing, that headspace, he wasn't actually very present at times, even though he was here. So I think it's a long answer to your question, sorry. Mm-hmm. I think that he has definitely evolved and definitely changed in how he is at home. He's much more present and he's much more coming from a different space. But it's been an incredible thing to see him evolve.
A few things I've taken from that is in terms of, it sounds like whatever you sort of put your hand to, Paul, you'd give it 110%. So if for whatever reason you wanted to become a teacher, I've no sort of worries that if you were to become a PE teacher, you'd be very good at that. Are you going to be a postman, you'd be very good at that. And whatever you put your mind to, you'd give it 110%. And on the other side of things, it sounds like Caroline, that whatever he puts his mind to, you're always going to be 100% behind him. And I think some of our kids, when they look at their future careers, they need to realise that whatever they do, they need to give it 110% to start with. But they also need to have people around them who are going to sort of commit to it as well and not just, you know, be that negative person going, oh, you shouldn't do this because you aren't going to earn much money. Or you shouldn't do that because it's going to be stressful. Do what you want to do. If it doesn't earn very much money, but you enjoy it, who cares? If it earns lots of money and it's stressful and you enjoy it, who cares? It's do what you want to do. And if you enjoy it and you've got the right people with you.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely 100%.
I think happiness, if anything's taught us this year, happiness is key. And we say to our boys, you know, do what you love because then it will never feel like work. You will feel like, oh my God, the money is actually a bonus because it feels just so natural to do what you do. That's how I feel about what I do. I feel really, really lucky to have found such an amazing profession. And I know for you, it's like, be happy. That's absolutely the bottom line.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Once it's making sure then that them people that you have around you are always, they're your soundboard. They're encouraging. Because you're going to have bad days. You are going to have bad days. But it's important that them people that you trust the most or you know that you can go to and have a conversation about are putting you back in on that line, that pathway again, and putting you on the positivity that you've always brought.
I 100% agree. And when I used to go to a gym in Solihull called Fitness First, and there was a member there, and I'm obviously not going to say his name, but I used to pop in after school and do a little gym session and get talking to him, and he'd say, if I've had a bad day, oh, why are you doing it? Why don't you speak to my cousin? He's a recruiter for school and he's getting 60, 70, 80 grand a year. And why don't you do that instead? And he was always the negative, why don't you do something else? And it did affect me at one point. I was thinking, yeah, why don't I go and do that? But then the thought of sitting in an office all day, just making phone calls, recruiting PE teachers, it's not what I want to do. I want to be a PE teacher. I did my degree to be a PE teacher. I've always wanted to do it since I was at school. And I think I could have carried on and sort of really bought into that and then been a year down the line and thought, I don't enjoy it. I need to get back to being a PE teacher. And I think, like you say, you've got to be surround yourself with the same board who's going to encourage and motivate and keep you on the right track for you, not just for other goals. In terms of your position is it sports psychology now, sports mindset?
It's sports mindset, yeah. I'm not a psychologist. I didn't take any qualifications for that. I'm not a mental health expert. I'm a mental health first aider. But yeah, I'm someone that's lived and breathed it for 22 years. So it's been part of my life, and I try and pass on my experiences in what the business was all about, was to help not just football, but sports people who are suffering, who will come up with obstacles that they might not be able to find a way around. And I'll try and help them, try and overcome them problems.
And what is something that you see from your experience of playing and what you're doing now from young athletes coming through, obviously for yourself in terms of football, but I think a lot of different sports can apply themselves to this. Apart from natural talent and the ability, what do you see from those who go on to succeed in comparison to those that sort of drop away and don't quite reach their potential in terms of their mindset?
It's the ones who, the ones for me are the ones who, rejection. I find rejection's the biggest thing. I mean, I suffered it when I was a young kid with being rejected. I was told that I was too small. I was never going to be a professional football player. But my mind was, no, it's what I want to do and I'm going to do it. You're not going to tell me what I'm not going to do. So yeah, when I become a professional football player, my first thought was of that coach who told me that was, well, I've proved you wrong straight away there. And it's trying to get them to understand that one door might shut, but there's going to be loads of other doors that are open. It's about taking that right path, never giving up and believing in your own ability, because we can't do that for them. We can advise them, we can guide them, but it's got to come from that person himself, that person or that lady, that girl who's finding it hard to sort of push themselves. It's within them and they have to find that way to carry on and not giving up so easy. So yeah, it's about just finding that rejection is okay, that's fair enough. This wasn't meant to be for me here, so I'm going to go and find a place that is going to be good enough for me, and I'm going to give it my all and never give up.
I think that applies itself as well in terms of the academic side of it. I'm a PE teacher, but I also teach GCSE and BTEC in Cambridge Nationals PE, these vocational courses. And sometimes we are a little bit brutal with our feedback, but it's not for the want of trying to discredit someone or just trying to make someone sad or disappointed. It's, I think in school you learn these skills, and I think students don't really recognize that at that age that they're at now, in terms of all these things that we do in school, giving them target grades, making them accountable. They don't realize that these things can help them in the future in terms of going for jobs, because guaranteed any student that listens to this will go for a job at some point and be rejected. And it's about not going, oh, I'm rubbish, then nobody wants me, I'm never going to work in that job. You just got to keep going and keep pushing and use it to your advantage and use rejection or failure or a challenge to learn. Yeah. I was flicking through Instagram the other day and I come across an athlete who, it was a combat sport, I think he might have been a boxer, and he listed his record, 14 wins and one learn in progress. And I thought that's a really good way of thinking of it, in terms of it's not 13 wins and one loss. You learn from your losses, and you learn from being challenged and pushed and held accountable and failing, really. You don't learn from turning up every week and winning 6-7-8-0. It'll feel good, but yeah, you don't learn from that. What have you seen in your career then from, let's move away from the playing side of it, but let's go towards sort of coaching, physios, that sort of thing. Because not all of our students are going to be professional athletes, unfortunately. But they might go into coaching, into physiotherapy, into nutrition, into other sporting roles. What do you see from those people who go on to be very good coaches or physios in comparison to those that think they know it all or potentially have that first class degree, but then actually don't go on to be a very good sports professional?
Yeah, I think the coaches and the physios, the ones that do their jobs the best, are the ones that they pay the most attention to detail, not just on what their job is, but on the person of what's their injury, how can I make them better, how can I make them stronger, because that's the most important thing. They've suffered an injury and there's going to be a weakness. So until you go back into your sport, you've got to make sure that you're physically stronger to go back into the sport without having a relapse in your injury. So I think it's important that the communication's massive as well in that, the understanding that the person understands, whoever's going through the treatment, is that they understand how long it may be. So they know in their head, right, I'm on this route now for 6-7 weeks. If I'm earlier, then bonus. I know that I've worked on it and I've made myself better. So yeah, I think they're the key things for the ones that are important. I think the ones that you see you struggle with, the ones who put things in your head that you don't want to put things in your head. So for me, I suffered a real bad experience when I was at West Brom and I was off for two medicals at two football clubs, and the physio that I saw at one of the football clubs suggested that I had a serious knee injury and my knee was going to explode in the next 2 years. So the thought of him telling me that, knowing that I'd never been injured before, I'd never been out, I'd never missed a game apart from being suspended. That was the only times I missed games. But for him to speak to me that way, I looked at him totally differently and I thought, why are you in a job like this if you're going to talk to your possibly players that you're going to work with in the future? You've totally put me off here and you've got in my head by saying that my knee's going to explode in 2 years. So again, you will come up with them type of physios and the type of people in sport who are quite negative and don't really have that communication skills to speak into people. And I find that they only get jobs because their mates are in a job and they give them. That's what I find. So yeah, it's finding the balance. And I think you've got to have clear communication. That's the most important. And I think the best people have them, the best coaches, the best teachers, the best sports people of like physios, et cetera, they have the best jobs because they're good at what they do and they communicate it to the person how they want to hear it.
And I see that as a teacher at school in terms of we have students come up and saying, I don't want to do this anymore because I'm going to fail and I failed the first time around. And it's that straight into negativity and it's not knowing how to sort of put their words across in a way that I guarantee that he doesn't want to fail, but it sounds like he wants to fail. It sounds like he's resigned to it. But that whereas somebody who got the exact same grade will come up to me and go, well, how can I get these extra grades to get better? And that early mindset in terms of looking up rather than looking down, I think spirals a little bit and it's sort of the snowball effect, and they get into a position like that as a physio and tell you your knee's going to explode. And that's straight into a negative and affects you. And you let's go on to you then there, Caroline, in terms of panic attacks and anxiety. Could you explain your experience? Because there'll be students listening who have felt the same way and how you overcame that.
Okay, so back in November, I started doing my Let's Talk Mind Health Instagram. And just to give a bit of background, the reason I wanted to do that is to normalise talking about mental health. And I thought the best way to do that to begin with is to be really transparent about my own experiences. Because I think, how can people really engage with you if you're holding something back? So I got my dad on my first Insta Live, and I thought my depression started at 19 after a car accident. I was going to my first ever first team hockey match. I got into the first team. It was a brilliant, feeling. And on the way, I was involved in an accident and I was in the back of the car. And unfortunately, I didn't actually play hockey much after that because of the pains in my back. From that experience, my depression really hit. And I went onto medication, and whilst that helped me, and I would never discredit medication at all, because if you're really, really down, the medication does help to bring you up to a level. But what it does from my own experience, is that it just plateaus you, it just keeps you numb. And I'm one of these people, I really need to experience life. I need to engage and smile. And I wasn't getting that from the medication. And at the time, there wasn't really much help out there. I went to a counsellor and, we talked about my problems, but I didn't really find any solution. So it was really getting back into exercise. I started to see a chiropractor and I got a bit stronger and I got my confidence back. And then I came off my medication very gradually under supervision, which is again really important. But when I spoke to my dad on the Insta Live, he actually thinks that my depression started a lot earlier, around 16. He saw that I was getting withdrawn. I never really had like a really close friendship group. I always felt like a square peg in a round hole. And so the pressures that you're under at that age to fit in, and you have all these hormonal changes, you have the pressures of exams, you don't feel like you're good enough, you don't feel clever enough, you know, you see, and these days it's a lot worse because you've got the social media aspect of seeing what people perceive as perfect, you know, everything's airbrushed, you don't see a real face. And I think that, you know, I was really struggling with that experience back at 16. And so when I was 19, my dad took me, I went to see a psychiatrist, and I didn't realize how bad it had got, because the turning point really was my dad talking to this guy about someone. And I looked at him and I went, "Who are you talking about?" And he looked at me and he was crying and he said, "It's you, I'm talking about you." And that was literally like the light bulb moment that I needed to drag me and go, "Oh my gosh, I can't believe that's me." So that's, I got back into fitness and the endorphins. I'm very much like a physical person. I needed that and it really helped me. And then through, obviously, then when I met Paul, you know, working, and I was much more calmer. I was exercising regularly and then had our first child, and it kind of, my anxiety was worse when I probably would say when we moved away. So I didn't have any support network near me. I didn't have any friends. It was like 1 minute we're in Watford and the next minute Paul's in West Brom. And I'm like, oh my God, I'm 25 years old. I have no idea what to do. So yeah, so moving away, that was a massive deal because I didn't have that support network and I was on my own a lot. Paul was obviously traveling a lot. My mum and dad both worked full time, didn't have any friends. And so I do believe like Luke was my saving grace. He was literally the reason for me to get up in the morning. I didn't really realize it at the time, but looking back, there were a lot of loneliness and a lot of dark times and, you know, miscarriages and, you know, not to go into too much detail, but one of the really dark times was Paul had just gone to Portugal and I was having a miscarriage and he wasn't with me. He wasn't able to be with me. And that's the side of football that people don't see. It's the side of life that people don't see. And it's not talked about. You know, I went home to see my mum and dad, and then my brother and his fiance were there, and he was just telling them that they were pregnant. And it's all these things that you're just, life throws things at you. And that's what I'm trying to get across, is that it's not all plain sailing. It's not all, you know, sunshine and unicorns. It can be really, really difficult. And those were really dark times, and having the distance was really hard. So the depression and the anxiety was always there. And then it really hit a pinnacle in 2013 when one night I woke up in the middle of the night and thought I thought I was dying, and people might think I'm being over exaggerating, and I'm not, because I actually said to Paul, "Phone an ambulance, I'm dying, I think I'm dying, tell the boys I love them." And I remember it so clearly, and my body, it was as if my body was just out of control. I had no control of my heartbeat. It was like the in cartoons when you see your heart coming out. And I was absolutely petrified, and Paul didn't know what to do. I mean, he phoned a nurse friend of ours and she talked me through it, and eventually I calmed down. But from that night on, I was having panic attacks every night, probably 3 or 4 times a night. And it got to the point where I was not going out. I was waiting for Paul to come home before I would actually leave the house. The biggest thing was taking the kids to school and trying to put that face on. And when I was at college, we were taught in our mental health kind of module that beware of the smiling depressive, because, you know, they are, you can hide mental illness, you can hide how you're feeling, and you withdraw from society to protect yourself. But then when you go out, it's like you have to put this face on, you have to put this armor on, and it's exhausting. And there was times when we would go out and I would literally not leave Paul's side, and normally I'm, you know, chatting and smiling and off and about, but there were times I was literally, don't leave me. And I'd be squeezing his hand and I'd be like, just stay with me. Oh my God, I think I'm having one. And he'd be like, you're all right. And so it was a lot of pressure for Paul as well to support me in that. And I've done lots of energy work before. I've done emotional freedom technique. I've done a lot of work like that on myself, which is tapping, which is the acupressure points, which really can help with the fight and flight and help with focus. But I needed something more, and I knew I needed something more. And it was only when I went to my chiropractor, and like I was going regularly because she was the only one I felt safe with outside of the house. She said, you need to go and see an acupuncturist. And I said, oh my God, what's an acupuncturist going to do? You know, they treat pain. That's all I thought acupuncturists did. And little did I know that she changed my life. She absolutely changed my life. My panic attacks, within 12 weeks, my panic attacks, yeah, I'd still have them, but they were so less frequent. And I felt like I was me again. So yeah, that's really my struggles in a nutshell. And I'm not saying I'm totally, you know, clear of that, because I feel so much with my heart and I connect with people so much that I'm also vulnerable like that as well. That's my vulnerability as well. So moving to different clubs, there was experiences that weren't very, very good for me. You know, I felt even more isolated because I didn't feel accepted. I didn't feel, you know, that people were wanting to talk to me. And so, you know, a young girl with a baby and you don't know anybody and nobody looks to look at you and smile or even come and say hello. And that's a really, really hard situation to be in. And from that moment on, I always said to myself, you know, there's no way I'm ever going to make anyone else feel like that, ever. And so whenever there was a new person, I'd always smile, go up to them, say, hi, you know, how are you doing? I know it's really hard. And it's taught me a lot. And it sounds weird. I would never not have had the experiences that I've had, because it's actually got me to where I am now. And it's given me a lot of experience to then help others.
From everything you've said there and everything you've said already as well, Paul, in terms of the both of you, you seem to be, you're obviously both very passionate people, but everything you've sort of achieved and succeeded with has come from listening and talking as the two main things, and not sort of boxing something up and keeping it away from people. That you as a captain, you as a professional footballer, listening, talking, discussing things. You're talking about coaches and physios have gone to be very good. It's about that level of communication and how people listen to you, and you overcoming and helping other people in terms of listening and talking, and what you're doing with your Instagram as well, listening and talking. It all comes from the same area. And that's obviously vital in terms of us as human beings. Really, you make friends by listening and talking, you impress people by listening and talking, you form relationships by listening and talking. Did your experience then with the acupuncture, is that what inspired you to become an acupuncturist, if I got that right?
I've always said I want to do something to help people. That's all I've ever wanted to do, help people. And I said it would have to come and find me, because I wouldn't have a clue where to go. And as I say, I've worked with emotional freedom technique. I've worked with lots of other modalities, but I wanted something really from the roots up. I needed something really grounded. And when I had acupuncture, my mind was blown with how easy the treatment seemed for the acupuncturist, like the flow, the communication. I felt like, you know, I could talk to her about how I felt, and I offloaded really in a safe space. But then I got treated for how I felt. I didn't just leave the room to think about how I felt. And so it was a really incredible experience to go in a place to feel totally safely held, to feel no judgment, to feel, you know, she didn't care what my husband did. She didn't care who I was. All she cared about was how I felt. And that's, as soon as I got better, I got to a point where I was like, this is what I want to do for people. If I can help one person to feel how I do now from where I was, then that is worth everything. So it took me a while to get there, because my youngest was, you know, I wanted him to start primary school before I really got my head into it. And then, yeah, a three-year course. And it was hard at times, not going to lie, but because I was so driven and I wanted it, and I was so supported because my mum and dad would come up really regularly to help look after the kids. Paul's mum and dad would, you know, Paul was always really supportive when I was like, look, I've got an assignment I've got to write and I have no idea where to start. I need some time out. So support is key, but the passion behind doing it is to help people, and just to see people and see their progress is just incredible.
That's really inspiring in terms of, now, you've taken something that could have held you back and you've used it not just to help yourself, but to help other people as well. And you're obviously driven to keep doing that in the future. To go off on a tangent then, coming towards the end, in terms of what values do you both instill then in your children growing up? So hopefully our students can listen to this as well and not almost take some of the things that you're saying as well and apply it to themselves. If they haven't got somebody giving them good guidance in terms of siblings, in terms of friends, they could listen to you two now and take some of this positivity and apply it to their lives. So what values do you instill? Not just, we speak a lot on here about work rate and hard work, but what else is there that can create success for a young person growing up, especially at the moment with the pandemic and being held back for sort of 18 months and not having that normal life?
I think the isolation from people has been a real massive factor. And I really do, you know, have so much compassion for the generation of school children now because of what they've had to go through. But also I would say is that they will have experienced something that we have never experienced. So they've evolved in a different way. They'll be so adaptive. They'll be able to, you know, if something comes across and they have to move, you know, pathways, then they'll have this resilience within them, whether they know it or not. What they've gone through has created so much resilience within themselves. And so what I try and remind our boys is, you know, our eldest is 18, and it's the same for the 18 to the 9-year-old, you know, it's about believing in yourself. And yes, there are outside, you know, influences, and, you know, at certain ages, it's not cool to be smart or to be outwardly smart. And I would say, you know what, make it cool to be smart, make it cool to be, oh my God, he's really working, she's really working, and they're really cool as well. So it's not about, there's a stigma of being the smart kid. There's a stigma of being the joker. You can be all of it, but at an appropriate time. And it's all about, for me, respect, yeah, respecting yourself and respecting others. And other people can only meet you where they're at. So it's really hard at 15, 16, because I wish I knew then what I know now, but people can only meet you where they are at. And so it's about having compassion and trying to understand that somebody is coming at you for whatever reasons you don't know, but it's down to you to react in a really responsible, but also authentic to you, stay true to you.
100%, I agree with that and massively. And it's come from that Joey Essex mentality, whereas I'm pretty sure he puts on an act that he's a little bit, he's not very bright and that sort of thing. And I'm pretty sure he puts it on for his career, but that's almost become cool to be like Joey Essex and be a little bit silly and be a little bit daft. But like you say, it's cool to be smart. It's because in 7-8 years time, when somebody's working really hard, regardless of what they do, you look up to them, you think, I wish I worked as hard as you, or God, you've got that success because you worked hard, either in school or in a job or in sport. You get in what you put out. It's what sort of absolutely I'm trying to get to.
I saw a friend earlier today, and she said something, and it really resonated with me, that she says to her son, it's like, don't be the kid that other people, when they grow up, they remember you as being the mean kid. Always, so when someone's like 25, they look back at school and go, oh, do you remember such and such? Oh my God, they were so mean. You don't want to be that person. You want to be the one that was like, oh, do you remember such and such? They're really nice. They're really kind. Like, they supported you. There was no judgment. If you're having a bad day, we could all like be honest with each other and say, do you know what? I'm struggling. That's the kind of people you want to be in life.
Yeah. You want to be, not in terms of, it's a little bit of a cliche in terms of legacy, but you want to be remembered as a nice person and somebody who was positive rather than negative and added value to someone rather than took it away. Finally, do you have any advice from both of you in terms of professional career? What does it take to be a professional sports person? What does it take to deal with setbacks? Any guidance in terms of overcoming challenges in terms of mental health. So any advice either of you'd like to give in terms of that?
I think you've got to be, it's got to be what you want to do. You can't force it upon you to be a professional athlete if it's not really the route that you want to go down. If you're looking at it from a different perspective of, well, I want a nice car, I want a nice house, I want to earn loads of money, then you're not in it for the right reasons. You've got to love what you do, and you've got to dedicate yourself to it, because it's not easy. So for me, it's important that you are fully focused on what you want to go and achieve and how you want to achieve it. I think, yes, there's always going to be challenges, but it's how do you overcome them challenges? It's putting your mind to it. So it's making sure that your mind is ready for, right, okay, well, that's come up. Like you say, the relegation for me, that was an obstacle because I'd been relegated and I didn't want to feel like that again. So, okay, I want to get promoted again. So it's always balancing it out and making sure that the positives are over outweighing the negatives, I look at it. So for me, yeah, it's important that you are fully focused and you're dedicated to what you want to do. It might be anything. It's just make sure that your mind's in the right place to do it and give it your all and do it with the best intentions.
100%. Thank you for giving up your time. I think one thing we can take away from this is the importance of communication and listening and then focus as well in terms of committing yourself to something 100%, regardless of what it is, and just giving everything you can, really, and making sure that if you look back in the future because something's failed or you haven't succeeded, at least you can go, well, I gave it everything, nothing more I could have done. It is what it is at the end of the day. And I think a lot of our students get tied down with the academic stress. They fail an exam, it's the end of the world. And, you know, it isn't. If you've given it 100%, you can't complain. The only sort of, I had this personally in terms of that feeling of, I didn't give it enough. So disappointment and regret when I did my A-levels and I got a C and 3 U's because I didn't give it enough. I gave PE everything, and I gave biology, maths and history nothing, and I got what I deserved at the end of the day. And I think you can move on from that quite easily, because you, as soon as you start to see challenges or failures as ways you can succeed in the future, it helps.
And also, I mean, if you don't know what you want to do, because look at me, I mean, I didn't find my true calling really until, I mean, say having a child is a calling, absolutely, but a profession, I didn't find it until I was in my late 30s. But you know what? I went and did a degree and I did it then. So I always think jobs and careers, it's all transferable. Just use the skills that you're really good at, build on your skills, and it's everything's transferable. You can find jobs in the most amazing and weird and wonderful ways. And sometimes being too connected to the end goal, you forget where you are right now, and it's like little steps. And also with mental health, you know, if anyone is struggling with mental health, you know, just find someone that you can talk to, because taking that first step, believe it from, you know, from my experience, you know, that first step of admitting that you've got a problem and you don't feel great and you're really struggling, it's hard to think about doing that, but actually the action is so much better than you think it's going to be, and it just helps you move forward so much quicker.
That's really good advice to finish on, and I'm going to make sure I clip that up and get that sent out to some people as well, so they can appreciate that. Thank you again for giving up your afternoon, especially while the Masters is on. I've got it on downstairs, so thanks for doing that. I really appreciate it. Right, guys, I think we've learned a hell of a lot from that, from other people's experiences, from other people's advice that we can apply to our own lives. And I can't thank the pair of them enough for giving us their time and sharing those personal experiences that we can learn from and we can apply to benefit ourselves. So stay tuned for the next episode, guys. That will be with Paralympic athlete Ali Jawad, and that is one not to be missed. I learned a hell of a lot, and I was inspired a lot from filming that episode, so I hope you guys are able to sort of benefit from that one as well. So enjoy the week, guys, and I'll see you back here for the next episode on Friday.